It's a beautiful day and a fine time for healing. Podcast host Randy Fine, a narcissistic abuse expert and the author of the groundbreaking book Close Encounters of the Worst Kind and the captivating memoir Cliff Edge Road, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being are all that matter. So put your feet up, relax, and enjoy today's show. And now, here's Randy.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. I am your talk show host, Randy Fine. Wow, do I have a show for you today. This is going to be so, you're going to be really intrigued to hear what my guests have to talk about, and I have two of them. Are you ready for a profound shift in your perceptions of love, life, and death? Are you open to the idea that you can communicate or connect with loved ones who have died? Do you wonder if there is an afterlife? In Beyond Ever After, today's special guests, authors Catherine Weisenberg and Jocelyn Montanaro, offer an all-encompassing message of hope, connection, and love. Catherine shares her psychic gift, allowing Jocelyn to communicate with her husband, Kevin, who is dying of brain cancer, both while he is in his coma and after his death. Jocelyn, previously a skeptic, chronicles the struggle of losing Kevin, while Catherine provides her spiritual perspective and insight from 30 years of facilitating conversations with comatose patients and the deceased. For several decades, Catherine Weisenberg has been sharing her unique ability to communicate and dialogue with comatose patients and spirit. She chronicles these conversations as they occur in a record she calls Writings. She is the concept creator of Lovality, a love-based approach to living and experiencing reality. She offers Lovality workshops, books, and cards. Jocelyn Montanaro has a bachelor's degree in international studies and a law degree. For many years prior to writing Beyond Ever After, Jocelyn was a lawyer working with divorcing couples, criminal defendants, and in general litigation. Good morning, ladies. Good morning, Jocelyn. Good morning, Catherine. How are you both? And welcome.
Well, good morning.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So there's a very interesting story that goes along with this, and it is the story of the book. And I mentioned in the opening that you talk to comatose patients, but I'm sure my listeners would want to know how this all occurred. So can you talk about what it is that, you know, what happened and how this all came to be?
With the gift of what I do, or the story that's in our book?
The story. Let's start with the story of Jocelyn, of how your husband, Jocelyn, it's your husband, right? Yeah. How your husband got into this position of being comatose.
Jocelyn, you want to take that? Maybe Jocelyn dropped the call. So I can take that.
She's actually still on. I don't know why we can't hear her.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
Maybe she'll call back in.
Hello?
Jocelyn. Okay. Can you hear us now?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes. Okay. All right. So asking you to please tell us the story about your husband and how he got into a comatose state.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I heard you. You just couldn't hear me.
Okay.
Well, what happened was my husband had brain cancer, and he was going in for surgery, and he had had a surgery before, 3.5 years earlier, and then it came back, and he was going in again to get the tumor removed, and we knew the prognosis was terminal anyway, that he had about a year left, but they were going to go in and take out the tumor to make the last year, you know, as best as it can be. And after the surgery to remove the tumor, an artery tore in his head in the recovery room, and he had a massive stroke. And then it all went downhill from there, kind of one thing after the other. And so about a month later, 26 days to be exact, my husband had been in a coma this whole time, and my sister had been friends with Catherine for years. And as you shared in your introduction, you know, Catherine has this very unique gift where she can dialogue with God, the deceased, and people in comas. And my sister kept saying, you know, you should have a session with Catherine. They call them writings because she writes down the communications that she receives to have a record of it. And I didn't want to do it. I was not a believer in God or a higher power. I mean, I certainly hoped there was one, but I'm a very direct experience kind of a person, and I just didn't believe. And so, and then my sister said, well, she's a prayer chaplain. You can pray, she can pray with you. And I thought, oh my God, no way. You know, I've been praying to God like crazy, not even sure if he exists. And my husband's just getting sicker and sicker. So I'm mad at this God I don't even know really exists for killing my husband. So the last thing I wanted to do was talk to him. But after a month in a coma, I just was at my end of my rope, and I didn't really know what to do. And so I thought, what the heck, you know? And so my sister set it up, and Catherine called me. I was on a hotel at UCLA, and she was in Washington State. She doesn't have to be right with you for her gift to work. And we started this communication, and into it very early on, this man, she says, I hear a man's voice. And I said, well, who is it? And he says, well, it's me, Kevin. And I said, well, where are you? And he just started this whole dialogue about what his experience was in this coma.
Okay.
Which was that he thought he was dreaming. But in the beginning, he just said some very general things about, you know, the kids and how were they doing and where were they and who was taking care of them. And I thought, you know, my sister Vicky could have told Catherine my kids' names and their ages. And I wasn't really sure it was him. And so I asked him a test question. I said, well, what's the last thing you remember, Kevin? And he said, I remember getting wheeled into the surgery, reaching up and taking Linda's hand and telling her, thank you for doing this, Linda. And I nearly fell off my chair because right after the surgery, the surgeon, you know how they always come out to tell you how the procedure went?
Yes.
And she said, you know, before I get into the details, let me just tell you, your husband's the nicest man. As we're wheeling him in, he reaches up and grabs my hand and says, thank you for doing this, Linda.
And my gosh.
And the only people that heard it were me and my two kids. And I never repeated it to anyone because 20 minutes later, the artery tore in his head in the recovery room. He was back into surgery. And then everything, every day was just this cascade of complications. And, you know, 26 days later, he'd have 5 brain surgeries. They're trying to fix it. He's in this coma. And he tells me the last thing he remembers, which is the last thing he said to the surgeon. So in that moment, I knew I was actually communicating with my husband, who was in the hospital, you know, half a mile away from me in a coma.
Okay, that is such an incredible story. What was your husband's prognosis?
Well, if you lived it, it's even more incredible.
I'm sure, okay. So what was your husband's prognosis for recovery, if at all?
What it was supposed to be was he was going to go in and get the surgery, and they were going to remove as much of the tumor as they could. And then he was back on chemotherapy, and we knew he was going to die in probably a year or so-ish, and he was supposed to be home in a couple days, and so his prognosis was terminal, but at least he had another year or so left.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just to make the last, you know, part of his life better.
Right,
and
right, better.
It didn't.
When did they expect that he would come out of the coma, or they weren't sure?
Well, they didn't know why he was in it. And, they didn't know why he was in a coma because when the artery tore in his head, they went back in and she said, I patched it up and it was really quickly. And there's only ever long-term damage if we can't get in there right away. You know, usually it's like about 4 hours, they say. And they were back in there within 20 minutes. And so she didn't think that there'd be any residual damage from that, but he just wasn't waking up. And so then they thought, well, there's fluid in there. So then they stuck a tube in to drain it, and they kept trying things, but they literally didn't know why he was waking up. And I kept saying to them, what is going on? Why can't you fix this? They're like, we have no idea why he should be awake. We don't know. And so then they kept trying things that didn't work. And until I had this first writing with Catherine, when he told us that he thought he was dreaming, and when we told him he wasn't, he conducted this experiment with which Catherine can share with you, and he, during the writing, started to wake himself up.
While we were on the phone.
Truly amazing.
While we were on the phone.
Yeah. So, Catherine, how did he describe where he was? I mean, he said he was dreaming. Did he describe anything about the afterlife, or what was his description?
Well, he did later on, you know. Mm-hmm. He kept arguing, you know, through me, through my facilitation. I connect with the energy, and then I turn it into prose. But she kept saying, you know, you're in the hospital, and I'm really scared. And he said, no, I'm in a post-anesthetic dream. And so he just seemed to be thinking he was dreaming. He was not conscious that he knew he had had the surgery, but he wasn't conscious that he was in a coma. And so, although when we were on the phone, he kept saying, how come I can hear you so clearly? So he alluded to certain things tangentially, you know, peripherally, but later on, he talked about that it was just like lights and sounds and, you know, like electrical sensations occasionally. So he didn't really give us a big description or give Jocelyn a big description about that. But later on, during his dying process and beyond, you know, these communications with Kevin and Jocelyn continued. And he did describe things, and he did, share.
Okay. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about that in a little bit. I want to save that.
Sure. But what's so unique about this, Randy, is, mm-hmm. you know, every morning, you and I, all of us, we wake up. You know, we may set an alarm if we have an unusual thing, but we don't ever think we have to do something to wake ourselves up. We just wake up, you know, every day of our lives, we wake up. And so he wasn't consciously trying. And once he realized he was in the coma, then he actually, said, well, then I'm going to see if I'm going to conduct an experiment to prove to himself that he wasn't dreaming, and when he was able to do that, he could rouse himself, which has large implications for lots of people in coma. So,
so how would you describe the experience of someone having a coma? So we know they can they hear us? Can they feel
Absolutely.
Us? Okay.
Absolutely.
And once they begin to wake themselves up, do they come out of the coma, or are they still in a partial coma?
Well, I can only tell you, I've communicated with coma patients a lot, facilitated that, and no one has woken up, nobody, except for Kevin. So I don't really know how to answer that, only to say that when doctors say we don't know if they hear you or not, they do hear you. And here's the thing, on the other side of it, because I facilitate a lot of communication with deceased people, they always, by and large, will report what was said to them while they were in a coma and dying. So after the fact, you know, I'll be working with someone, and they'll say, you know, thank you. It was just like you told me. It was just like crossing the road. And the person will say, you know, I had held my grandmother's hand and said, you know, Grandma, I think it's okay. It's just like crossing the road. And they'll recount actual dialogue people have had at deathbed. And so I know from that, and they know from that, they heard everything.
Okay.
So.
Okay, so they are conscious, but they're in just an in-between state, sort of a dream state, actually. That's fascinating, and I hope that the medical field can learn a lot from what you do. Have you had any other interesting experiences you want to share about communication with someone in a coma?
Well, I mean, only that they can hear us. I mean, you know, I had a and these are not like, oh, I heard you tell me you loved me or anything like that. They're specific dialogue, and sometimes it's innocuous dialogue. I had a young woman who had died, and her mother and her best friend came. And she said, like, first thing she said to him was, why didn't you just cut my hair? And they started crying. Well, of course they're going to cry. They've lost their, you know, their loved one. But they said, you know, the hardest cases is when you have to take someone off a ventilator or off life support.
Right.
And so just they said, you know, when they were making those decisions when she was in the hospital, she was a person who always cut her own hair. You know, there's those kind of women who just cut their own hair. And they said the mother and the best friend were talking to each other, and they said, you know, she'd probably want us to cut her hair, you know, and they were laughing. So she chose that, but that meant she not only heard that comment, she heard all the I love yous and all the how hard this is and all the goodbyes and everything. And, you know, so, yes, to keep talking to your loved one, to know that they do. I mean, I think they do hear you. So, and I've got hundreds of those kinds of stories, but
I'll
yeah,
bet
it's
you
pretty
do.
Amazing.
I bet you do. Jocelyn, your husband was a great support for you in how to make decisions and how to proceed. Talk a little bit about that, what you asked him and what he told you he wanted.
He was. And I met Kevin when I was 25. And from that point forward, you know, every important decision I made, I talked over with him. And so to have, you know, the love of your life in a coma and you can't talk over with them what to do, being able to talk over with him was, and through this whole process through when he died, made the whole thing just so much better because I was able to do what he wanted. Even if I didn't want to do it, I knew what he wanted done. So, for example, when we were in the coma, the first writing, when he was first in the coma, he wanted me to not continue medical intervention if it looked like it wasn't going to work out. And he wanted to set a time limit on it. And I was like, well, how about 90 days? And he's like, how about 30? And we kind of went back and forth with Catherine, you know, in between. You know, we're both lawyers, my husband and I. So we're trying to negotiate this, you know, deal. And, Catherine's husband's a lawyer, too. And she's just like, I could just see her kind of rolling her eyes when we're having this conversation. Because he's like, you know, we got to set a drop-dead date. And I was like, how about 90? He goes, that's too long. How about 30? And then he said, how about 60? And I said, fine, but I was already thinking in my head, there's no way I'm going to do this in 60 days. And he said, right when I was thinking that, he said, I know what you're thinking. You're already thinking about ways you're going to circumvent this in 60 days. And he was right. I was thinking that. He knows me so well, he was right. I was thinking that. And then he also told me, and this is a common theme throughout all the writings, was that he did not want me to be angry with God, and he did not want me to blame God for the situation because he knew I was really angry at God, if there was one, and I was, you know, I needed a place to channel all my anger, and, you know, the big guy definitely got it. And so he was, that was a very common theme, and he kept saying, this isn't a failure, and I wish I had let you know what I know, and that was really the main thing. Don't you think, Catherine, through all the writings, is not to be mad at God and blame him for all of this?
And really, I think, and, you know, you read the book, Randy, so you know, but I think that the whole theme of Kevin and Jocelyn is how much he loves her, and he's helping coach her through his death. He's being present to her for you know, on how to navigate this. And so even though he's the one who's dying, he's more concerned with helping her. He's even like, you know, we talked about this, you know, and she's like, no, we didn't talk about this. And he's like, yes, you knew what I wanted. And she's like, no, I didn't. And I think that it really speaks to people who are thrust in this situation. You know, we do what we can because we love, and we try all kinds of things, even sometimes knowing it may not be what the other person wants, or, you know what I mean? Because we're just so frightened of losing them. So I also think that for people in those situations, you know, Kevin got to tell, you know, and it also tells us, you know, the importance of having a do not resuscitate and making your wishes known to your family. So, you know, we see in the book, as you know, Jocelyn's going through all this loss and this extra layer of how do I make the right decision? What is the right decision? And I think that it helps people see this loss process.
Yeah. And Kevin was very accepting of it. And, you know, I've thought about this a lot since then because, you know, when we told him, you are in really bad shape, and I listed all the things that were wrong with him, and they were numerous. I mean, he was just a train wreck physically. And, you know, his response to hearing all that was, well, it sounds pretty bad. You know, you better be ready to let me go. And not one word of like, oh, no, or, you know, no, not one sentence of feeling sorry for himself about it or worried about himself. When he heard everything that was wrong, he said, well, you better basically get ready to let me go because this sounds pretty bad. and I'm like, it's not that bad. And he goes, it sounds pretty bad. So, but he wasn't worried about dying, you know, and I was the one that was worried. And he said, you know, I'm not worried about dying. It's not a failure. I'm complete with it, but I can tell that you're not. I mean, he knew I wasn't. And so I really think a lot of why he hung on as long as he did was to get me to the place where, you know, I was, you know, I knew it was really going to happen and that it was, you know, not the best time because there's never a good time. But if it had happened sooner without these conversations, I think it would have been just so much harder for me.
So tell me exactly, like, how did this go down? So, Catherine, were you always on the phone? Were you sometimes bedside? And how quickly were the questions and the answers coming? So, you know, because you're telling me you're negotiating 30, 60, 90, but it wasn't like you and I are talking. How quickly was
this
happening?
No, it was like you and I are talking. It was exactly like you and I are talking.
It was that quick.
So the first one we did on the telephone, and then the second one, she was to bring him home the next day, and I sometimes get these, I call them nudges, and I knew I needed to go to UCLA, and I live in Santa Barbara too, and so I called her and I said, you know, I think I need to come down there. I think I'm supposed to. And she's like, no, no, no. And you get a sense of Jocelyn. When Jocelyn says no, it's pretty firm no. And her sister, I was recovering from a detached retina, and her sister was able to drive me down there. So I did that one in person. And when her husband was in hospice, I came and did one in-person bedside. The one in UCLA, she said, we arrived there and at UCLA, her sister and I, and he was back in a coma. He had roused himself for a brief period, but then he, you know, went back in the coma. And she was like, we're going to go outside. And I looked at this man who was in a coma, and I thought, aha, what? You know, I'm in a hospital room. And she put him in a wheelchair, and we rolled outside to this lovely garden area. And I think we were probably out there how many hours? I don't know, Jocelyn, quite a few.
Maybe
that
three.
That writing was 68 pages long. But it's just like what you and I are doing. So I write and write it down only because I want the record of it. And then I read it to the person. So it's very much a back and forth, just like we're doing.
Amazing.
So it isn't like, you know, ask a question and wait 3 hours and get an answer. You
That's
know,
amazing.
It's
That's
instantaneous.
Amazing. Now, are you hearing or are you just doing automatic writing?
I'm not doing automatic writing. That always throws people out. And I guess automatic writing is I just am, you know, willy-nilly writing and not in control. But no, I am.
Somebody's. Okay.
Yeah. Maybe that's my headset. I'm going to go speaker. So I'm not, it's not automatic writing. And I ask you this, when you think a thought in your head, are you hearing a sound?
Mm-hmm. No.
Are you hearing a voice? So,
no, I'm not. No.
Yeah, so it isn't that I'm hearing a voice. It's more that I'm feeling this energy and that I'm somehow able to translate that into prose, into words. Although I am catching the nuances of the person. There's always, with deceased people or people in comas, there's always things about them that stand out. I say it's kind of like experiencing a person from the inside out, not like a possession or anything weird like that.
But
right. There's always a characteristic, like, sometimes it may be that you can feel their mouth moves weird or, you know, it's strange what will pop out about an individual, but it's very normal. Jocelyn will tell you, it's just like, it sounds all strange, but when you're doing it, it's just like we are, you know. It's like you're sitting and having a cup of coffee with somebody. It's not woo-woo-y or... You
right.
know, I'm from the Midwest, so I'm not real intimidating or whatever. I'm very normal for my unusual skill set. So.
Well, that's okay. I mean, we have a caller, and I want to see what the caller's question is. Sometimes people call in thinking they're going to get a reading, but we're not doing readings today, so let's see.
No.
Good morning, caller. Your area code 519. Did you have a question for Catherine and Jocelyn?
Oh, hi, Catherine and Jocelyn. I was just listening, but
okay.
Can I make a comment?
You absolutely can.
Okay, I volunteer for hospice, and way back when my son was like 4 years old, an electrical wire went on fire and almost went into the swimming pool, and I'd said to my son, I said, you know, we're lucky we weren't in the pool, we would have died. He says, who cares? We'd just end up in paradise.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow. Wise child.
Whoa. Oh. You must have got chills through your body. Oh, my gosh. Okay. Great comment. Thanks.
So
I'm going to put you back on hold.
Okay.
And you can keep
perfect.
Listening, okay?
Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for the comment. Oh, my goodness. Unbelievable.
And Randy, I'd like to say something about what Catherine was speaking to before you took that call, and that is that when she's doing the writings and she's relaying verbal, so what she does is she's relaying verbally what she's hearing as she's writing it. So she's doing a lot at once. She's, you know, getting the download as the best way I could call it. She's saying it as she's here, you know, getting it, and then she's writing it at the same time. But when she's saying it, the inflections she uses are the same as Kevin. So when she says, you know, it's really like he's talking, but it's her voice. But he'll go, like, I just remember this one thing in the UCLA writing, the second one where she came down. And he said, you know, I was saying something. And he's like, you know, don't give me that. And he said it just like he would say, don't give me that. He goes, I've tangoed with you too many times for that. And the way she said it, like the way her voice went up in certain words, and it sounded just the way he would say it. And also they use terms of endearment, you know, like, and you know, just it's exactly the same. It's just Catherine
specific one.
Saying
yeah.
It. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's very surreal to have someone who's not your husband talk like they're your husband, and they're not, and he's right there in a coma. You know,
that would be really weird, wouldn't it?
Right. You know, these kind of things often happen to people who have no idea what any of this is about, and they get very caught off surprise. And I think sometimes it's a sort of a wake up message because, you know, I believe spirit's always talking to us. Many people tune it out
Absolutely.
And when you're not aware that it's there, you know, it's not even a blip on your screen. So, you know, I feel like sometimes spirit is screaming at us to listen and wake up, and sometimes they have to do something very big and, you know, miraculous to wake
right.
some people up. But that's what I believe was going on here. Why do you believe this happened to you, Jocelyn?
Me? Okay. I was going to say, why do you think Catherine got her gift, which that's a great question, too.
No.
Randy, I have no idea. I've asked myself that often because I am nobody special. And not only that, I was so mad at this God I wasn't even sure existed. I mean, why would I get to have this opportunity? Because it was really such a blessing, and blessings, as you know, are blessings. They don't come from anywhere other than that. And I the answer is, I don't know. I have no idea, but I'm profoundly grateful, and I hope that in sharing the story, it kind of takes some of the sting out of, you know, his loss. Because Kevin always wanted to take a missions trip. That's in the book, and he was too sick to do it. And I feel, in a way, that this book, with the messages that, you know, his conversations when he's in a coma and when he's deceased, is that missions trip that he never got to take in life, you know, just conveying what he believes to be true and, you know, real for all of us.
Now,
and he's coaching her just as he's coaching the readers in a way, you know.
Right.
He was a very faithful man. He was a service-oriented person. He was a difference maker. And how many of us, you know, we lead good lives and we do what we can, which we all should be doing, or, you know, not a should, but, you know, is the way you want people to be. And this is really his presence and his impact and his ability to reach and touch other people is alive and present in the book. So I also think that, you know, spirit had a greater plan. It was a blessing for Kevin. It was definitely a blessing to Jocelyn. But we've been very surprised how robust the sales have been, and how people have said, I'm not afraid to die anymore. This is how I thought it worked, or, you know. And that's just, you know, what it's all about, really.
We actually have two more callers. I want to just see if anybody has a comment. Okay, anybody else has a comment? Good morning, area code 775. Whoops. Okay, that person is gone. Let's try this one. good morning, area code 408. Did you have a comment for Jocelyn and Catherine?
No, I'm basically just listening. I'm sorry.
Okay, no, that's okay. It's perfectly fine. I'm going to put you back on hold. You're welcome to listen. I just wanted to make sure that you didn't want to chime in, but I'm going to put you back on hold.
I kind of have to go.
Okay, so what I wanted to ask you, Jocelyn, is where have you gone in your mind with your spirituality since this happened? Has it progressed? Or are you just basically with what the experience happened?
Well, it's impossible to have this experience and not be changed spiritually. And I, you know, I wasn't a spiritual person. And I wouldn't say now that I am in the traditional sense that people think someone is, you know, spiritual. But I've had a direct experience. And so, you know, my beliefs are from my direct experience, and I know now that obviously there's a higher power, however you want to, you know, describe that. And I also know now that when you die, there's someplace else that you go, and I know that it's different. Catherine can tell you this: it's people have different death experiences; they have different afterlife experiences. But knowing that there's something after, and knowing that there is a higher power, I don't worry like I used to, and I don't fear death. And I think a lot of what spirituality is for people is, you know, having a sense of what lies after, that our life here is bigger than just our life here, and that there and that there's this universal love that kind of permeates everything. So that would be it for me.
That's great. I mean, that's my, you know, I've believed in this for a long time, and it really takes the fear out of living and the worry out of living, because you know that you're just supported and there's a plan. You know, you're going to be here, then you're going to go somewhere else. I wanted to mention the look on Kevin's face when he actually passed away. What happened there?
That was probably one of the most profound moments of my life, because when he died and his heart had stopped beating and he had stopped breathing, I mean, he was dead. And, you know, literally the moment after that, his eyes flew wide open and his right eye had been stitched shut because they couldn't figure this out either, but for some reason, the right side of his face he was paralyzed, like had a palsy. And so they had actually stitched his right eye shut at UCLA, and then we were coming back to Santa Barbara to go to hospice. I had them take the stitches out because it really bothered me that he was going to die with one eye stitched shut, and he had these beautiful blue eyes. And so when he died, his eyes flew wide open, and he let out this surprised gasp, like, and he had this look of, like, wonder and awe and joy on his face, just, like, completely blissed out. Like, I'd never seen that look on his or anyone's face. And it was, I could tell he saw something. And it was weird because he hadn't been able to open his right eye in weeks, and they both flew wide open, and he saw something, and then that was it. And there were two other people in the room, and I said, "Did you see that?" And they both saw it, but they're like, "Well, you know, after you die, there's, you know, neurological, you know, synapses still firing and stuff." I said, "Uh-uh, that was not that. That was not a synapse firing." And then after he died, I had another writing with him, and I asked him, you know, "What did you see when you died?" Because I know he saw something, and he shared what he saw and what the experience was. He said that it was just this overwhelming love, and he felt infinitely large and infinitely small at the same time. And he said it was just total and complete love, and he was in this place that he'd been trying to touch his whole life. That's what he said the moment was like. He said,
"Oh my
gosh,
complete,
utter acceptance and love."
You know, Steve Jobs' last words were, "Oh wow, oh wow, oh wow."
Yeah.
So,
and you know, I think, I'm not surprised.
Right.
I'm not surprised for what Kevin describes. It was just, you know, glorious. So
glorious. Oh my gosh. I know. Yeah, I'm so excited to experience it. You know, I mean, I maybe I'm crazy, but I look forward to that. I'm going to live as much as I can live when I'm here. But I look forward to that moment. I think that is, I just would love to experience that. You know, I think we all would.
Well, we all get to. So,
yeah.
You know, all of us have that moment at some point, obviously. So,
right. I mean, it's just great. I love this message. I love that you're sharing this message. And Kevin is behind the whole thing, of course. So what has, Catherine, what has Kevin told you about the afterlife?
Well, you know, Kevin, the first six writings, and Kevin in his own words describes that to Jocelyn. But I think the idea is it's not a one-size-fits-all afterlife. So I've done hundreds of these. And Jocelyn alluded to this earlier, you know, what we believe is what we receive in a way. So
okay.
For Kevin, he was a Christian, so he got the traditional kind of, he said when he died, he was met by Jesus. And Jesus, turns out Jesus gave him a hug, and Jesus is a really good hugger. And so, but you know, the afterlife or whatever is a state of consciousness. It works here, you know, you and I get up in the morning, we get dressed, everything happens linearly, you know, boom, 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 and we're moving through experiences. But in the afterlife, they're not bound by those same kinds of things. So they can think it, let's say, and I don't know if think it's the right term, but they can have multiple experiences at once. And there's no like, oh, I want to go see, you know, Italy, probably maybe not a good choice, but I want to go see Italy. And then you just think, oh, that's the Sistine Chapel, you know, and boom. So because there's none of those time spatial things like what we have here. And also, you know, that love, which we already are, but everything is more amplified. So in that way, you know, and that's why I encourage people to, like, you know, don't think I'm going into the black void. Oh, my gosh, it's going to be dark or whatever, which is difficult not to, you know, it seems like it's all, you know, who knows. But to hold that light, you know, if you're a Buddhist, you're not going to be hugged by Jesus. But you are going to have your experience that's going to be in line with what you anticipate is going to be, you know.
Right.
Like here, what we focus on is sometimes what we get.
You know, Kevin used the analogy of an orgasm in the book, didn't he?
He did, and you know, I when we went, and it's funny because I, when we were writing the book, the one thing I felt about in the editing process was that the writings didn't get touched, that everything that was said was left exactly in as it was said, because I, you know, I wanted it to be as accurate as possible, and a lot of these writings were recorded, which Catherine doesn't normally do. I don't know how she got the inkling to do that, so I was able to, you know, listen to them after, which was kind of fun in a way. But
yep.
Are you there?
That was the analogy. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry.
Oh, so yeah. So what
yeah,
exactly
so,
did
so,
he
so
say?
Anyway, so I didn't want to take that out, even though it was a little awkward. You know?
No, I think it's funny. Yeah.
It was funny, and the thing is Kevin is such a proper and upright rule-following kind of a guy and would never say anything that could be, like, slightly interpreted as crude or, like, inappropriate. And so when he said that, I was really surprised. And if you
what exactly
see the book,
did
he says,
say?
You know,
what were his words?
Well, he said, well, you know what, if you wait one second, I have the book in the other room, but what he said was, he goes, you know, forgive me, Catherine, for being impolite. You know, but
yeah.
it's like an orgasm, but multiplied 1,000 times because that's what it was like. And
oh my
so
gosh!
It was funny when she was reading it. She goes, "You know, forgive me for being impolite." I thought, "Oh boy, you know, what's she gonna say?"
What's
and then when
next?
He said that, I thought that was so funny because it's just so out of character for him to use that kind of analogy. So it must have been really, you know,
it must have been amazing.
Yeah,
and a good
awesome.
One for the indescribable.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Jocelyn, tell us about the squirrel.
Okay, and then this is a great part of the story and something that Catherine can speak to afterwards, these divine synchronicities. But after Kevin died and I had the first after-death writing, my birthday was the next day. And I hadn't talked about it with Catherine. You know, I had nothing to celebrate, obviously. And when I woke up on my birthday, I was, you know, unhappy and bummed by myself for the first time in a long time. And I decided not to go to work. I was going to have a pity party instead of a birthday party. And I went to Vaughn's and I bought like champagne and, you know, cheese danishes and orange juice. And I was going to, you know, go home and pig out and feel sorry for myself. And Catherine called me when I was in line at the grocery store and said she had was it my birthday? And I said, well, yeah, how'd you know that? And she said, well, I have a gift for you. You know, why don't you come on over and get it? And so I did. And it was, she said, you know, I knock on her door and she's in her bathroom and she hands me the stack of papers and says, you know, Kevin wanted to wish you happy birthday. And in that unsolicited birthday writing, which he does send unsolicited writings, and there's two of them in the book. He tells me that he's going to try to send me a sign and to keep my eyes peeled. So, you know, the days after that, I'm like looking in the closet and stuff, thinking, you know, what's this sign going to be? And a few days later, I'm sitting on the couch with my kids watching The Office, and our dogs, we have these two big dogs, a Doberman and a German Shepherd, and they start barking furiously in the backyard. And I look in the backyard, and there's a squirrel sitting on the fence. And the dogs are jumping on the fence, and the fence is, you know, lunging back and forth. They're trying to eat the squirrel. And I'd never seen a squirrel in my yard, ever. I've lived here 19 years. I'd never seen a squirrel. And there's this one on the fence. And Kevin had this thing for squirrels. He loved squirrels. He was born back east where there was lots of squirrels. And he just had this thing for him. And every time he would go up in the mountains, he would buy unshelled peanuts at the store, the first stop at the way into town, and line them up on the deck and then watch the squirrels eat them through the windows and laugh in the morning when the shells were gone and line them all up again. He just loved squirrels. And so when I saw the squirrel, and the squirrel is on the fence, and the dogs are trying to get it, I'm looking at the squirrel, and it's looking right at me. It's like not moving. It's just staring at me. And we stared at each other, and I said to my kids, "Look, it's Kevin." And and I pointed out to the squirrel. It's so weird. And I said, "It's a sign. It's Kevin. It's a sign." And we all looked at the squirrel, and it sat there for what seemed like 5 or 6 minutes, and then it calmly walked off. And then the next writing, he did say, yes, in fact, the squirrel was a sign from him. And since then, I get signs all the time. Like, I'm driving in my car and I have the radio turned on, and I'll think of Kevin. The next song that comes on is Brown Eyed Girl from Van Morrison, which is always the song he attributed to me because I have brown eyes. And so I get these all the time, and other people do, but they really just don't pay attention. And Catherine, do you want to speak to that?
Well, I think that's what we want is people to, and you said it too, Randy, earlier, is that things are happening and they're on the edges, they're on the periphery. And I would just encourage your listeners that when you have these kind of experiences, and we all have, where you smell grandma's perfume and she's been gone, or you feel a presence, or you find a little note or whatever, that you don't say, oh, that's just a coincidence, oh, that's crazy, that means nothing, that you let yourself have that, because your loved ones oftentimes are trying to send you these messages, you know. And the more, I think, the more that you open to that, then the more that that can happen. We actually have on our website, beyondeverafter.com, the opportunity for people to share their story, because we're all having these experiences, and for some people, it's the most intimate thing that's happened, you know. And so, they're sending us signs. I call them divine synchronicities. They're more than signs, you know. Signs
you
or
know,
warnings, or you know.
Right. They're synchronicities, and also, you know, I always talk about how, you know, everybody's waiting for this great big miracle. They think a miracle is this great big thing in their life, but we have miracles all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That we, you know, that are like synchronicities or messages or things like that. Things just happen, and they're profound for the moment. But you know, I think people need to understand that miracles happen in our lives all the time.
And I think when we verbalize it, it becomes more real to us. And it also helps other people say, oh, and everybody, you know, when you share something, they're like, oh, you know, I had this weird thing that happened to me. And I think we find they also are more commonplace. So there's more permission to notice and to feel it and to share it, you know,
right,
which is the way consciousness changes. Openness.
Absolutely. We're trying. I do this show because, you know, I try to bring enlightenment and information and mindfulness and everything to people. You know, I want people to be able to hear a variety of situations and be able to grasp on to whatever feels right for them. So, go ahead. I'm sorry.
If I have another minute or two, I have a kind of a miracle slash divine synchronicity story with Kevin that I think your listeners might like, and this
okay.
is not in the book. But a couple years ago over Christmas, I went to Las Vegas with my son, and I was there with some friends, and we were walking in this mall to come out on Las Vegas Boulevard, and this man grabs my arm and stops me and tries to sell me one of those little things that goes on your head to massage your head. And I'm like, no, I don't want it. No. And he's like holding onto my arm. And I'm like, you know, come on, let me go. I don't want it. I don't want it. And then my son comes over and he's like, you know, she doesn't want it, you know? And then he's like, look, just give the guy $10. And so we get out of here. So we do, and we leave. And as we walk out the door, I see all these people on the sidewalk falling. And we had just missed that woman who had driven down Las Vegas Boulevard and had plowed all those people down on the sidewalk. And if that guy hadn't stopped me, I would have been standing right where that car, waiting for the crosswalk with all those other people to go to our hotel. I would have been standing there, and we would have been plowed over by that car. And
I
knew that Kevin had something to do with it. And in the next writing, he brought it up, and he said, when you were in Las Vegas, I go, he said, first thing he said, he goes, that was me. And I go, I knew it. And Captain's like, what are you talking about? And you know, I told her what happened. And I said, how did you know? And he said, you know, he gets alarm bells. He gets like alarm warnings. He said, I can tell sometimes when you're going to be in danger. And so he was like a guardian angel. He got this weird guy to stop me, and it prevented me from getting plowed over in the crosswalk.
That is an amazing story,
it's miraculous. And so, people, when things like that happen, you should look up and go, "Thanks," you know.
Right. I go thanks all the time for every little thing, all day long. I'm like, "Thanks for that," you know, because the more grateful you are, and the more you recognize these things, the more they occur in your life. We're coming down to the end of the show. The book is Beyond Ever After, A Heart-to-Heart Journey Through Death and the Afterlife with Catherine Weisenberg and Jocelyn Montanaro. Where can we get this book, ladies?
Yeah, it's on Amazon. It's just one computer click away.
Okay, that's terrific. And, you know, Catherine, my son is a surgical resident out in Ontario, California, so he's not far, you know, from where you are.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going to keep your name because sometimes he has families that are around people, and it would be really nice for him to have that resource. So he's interested in this kind of stuff too. So I'm going to pass
sure
that on. Yeah, I'm going to pass that on to him. So did you want to leave us with a message?
Well, I guess the message would be that, you know, our loved ones are always with us, that the portal of our heart, the love we have for our pets, our loved ones, our friends, anybody who's gone, that they still live in our heart, and we have complete access to them through that. So though what I do and our book talks about is very, you know, specific, that never think just because someone's gone, they're gone. They're there. The love that you feel for and with them is real. It's your access point. And, you know, love is eternal. You know, love doesn't have a shelf life. Our bodies may, but love never does. So that would be the message.
That's a great message. Love. And like you said, it's for our pets. I just believe love never dies. You know, love is eternal. That is the one thing that never, ever, ever dies. So,
and we're designed and made for it. You know, we're it. We are it.
We are love, right? We are love. And, you know, I'm glad. I remember years ago when I was trying to really look into these things and learn, get deeper into it, and I started reading about love, and it made me very uncomfortable because I never heard about love in the terms of it being this universal thing between everyone. To me, love was, you know, a romantic thing. But I'm so glad that that word love has been broadened and people embrace it and understand the concept of universal love and the importance of it. So anyway, it has been an absolute pleasure having you ladies with me. I wish you great success with the book, and I know my listeners will be picking up a copy of this because this story is so fantastic and so hopeful for many people. So I want to thank you very much for this gift. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Kevin, for the book. It's been great. I'm glad to have been a part of it. And
well,
I wish you a
you.
Wonderful, beautiful day.
You too.
And thanks for having us.
Okay. All righty. Bye-bye. So we are out of time, but if you have any comments or questions about today's show, you can email me at loveyourlife@randyfine.com. May joy and serenity always be yours.
We hope you enjoyed today's show. Visit randyfine.com, RANDIFINE.com, and be sure to sign up to receive updates on the latest blog posts, events, and upcoming shows. Thank you for listening.